This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, U.S. imperialism has definitely seen better days, especially in the Arab and Muslim world. And local activists in Washington, D.C. want to take the case of a teacher killed by private police to the United Nations. But first, a conference on the Black radical tradition will be held at Temple University in Philadelphia, January 8th through the 10th. Dr. Anthony Montero is one of the organizers and a keynote speaker for the event. We asked Dr. Montero, how alive is the Black radical tradition today?
The Black radical tradition is always present when there's movement and activism. People, and especially young people, instinctively look for ideological and political foundations for what they're doing after a point. And so we observed in the framework of the anti-police state Black Lives Matter movement a need for and a call for a conference that would address ideological as well as practical issues. And so we called it, we began organizing really concretely about 4 months ago, and suddenly this thing has blown up, which suggests to me and to others that the tradition that we call the Black radical tradition is alive and is on the verge of reasserting and manifesting itself in this moment of struggle, in this approaching third decade of the 21st century.
Well, you say we, you're speaking of the Black Radical Organizing Collective. Could you describe the organization?
Well, the organization is made up of mainly young people and seasoned activists from Philadelphia, but also people like Mark Taylor from Princeton and Joanna Fernandez from Baruch College, both of whom have been longtime activists in the Mumia movement, Mumia Abu-Jamal movement, but a slew of extraordinary young people, college students, as well as young people from the communities and from the various organizations around the city.
Now, this is the first of its kind at Temple University, and I believe the first of its kind in a long time nationally.
Yes, no question. Definitely it's the first of its kind for Temple University, unless you want to talk about the 1970 constitutional conference called by the Black Panther Party. But I don't know that even it, or the Black Power conferences that were held in Philadelphia in the late 1960s, I don't think any of that rose to the level ideologically of what we're doing. For example, this conference will explicitly be anti-capitalist and anti-USA empire and pro-socialist. That doesn't mean that everybody will be a socialist, but not only are we talking about an assault through democratic means and people's organization upon the white supremacist social system, but it's twin the neoliberal capitalist economic structures. So we're talking about a double assault in the name of democracy, in the name of freedom, and connecting all of this to the struggle against the global hegemonic policies of the United States, which in our estimate also includes the destruction of the biosphere and the atmosphere and the foundations of human and natural life on the planet.
Why is it so necessary to raise the banner of anti-capitalism? The current political fervor in the black community revolves around the police.
Well, because the political fervor is also being driven by a questioning of the economic and social foundations of the police. People are not just talking about police misconduct, they're talking about the police state and the prison industrial complex and the national security state and war and peace. So I think already it's out there. If you take organizations like the Organization for Black Struggle in St. Louis, People's Organization for Progress in North Jersey, Black Youth Project 100 in Chicago and other places, the Dream Defenders out of Florida and other places, you put all of this together, what you see is not just a demand that rogue cops, as they're called, be put on trial, but people are calling for an end to the police state itself. And along with this are calling for an end to neoliberal capitalism. I think it's already out there. It's not that we're inventing something or attempting to impose a set of theoretical or political demands upon a movement. In fact, these demands are already present in the movement.
That sounds like a radical trend that could not be endorsed by the Democratic National Committee.
And we hope it is not endorsed by the Democratic National Committee. And one of the things I think, if not all of us, at least people like myself, will be putting forward is that the policies of the National Democratic Committee and the strategy of those associated with the Democratic Party, that all we have to do is elect Hillary Clinton and things will get better. We are going to attack that very notion and say that the only way that things are going to get better is to reject the Democratic Party and to establish foundations within the people, within this broad category that we social scientists call the people, to establish foundations for real politics, for real movement, for real organization that can bring about real change.
Keynote speakers are the people who set the tone for conferences such as this. You've got Angela Davis, Robin DJ Kelly, yourself, Vijay Prashad, Cornel West. Is there a line that one could say unites all of you keynoters?
And I would add to that, Charlene Carruthers from Chicago, one of the young leaders out there, Jamala Rogers from St. Louis, Ferguson, the Dream Defenders, they'll all be a part of keynoting, as it were. I think what unites us is that this is a coming together of the black left, the real black left. And, you know, that doesn't mean that everybody will agree upon everything. But one thing we will agree upon, I think, one, that the struggle for black liberation is central to every struggle for change in this country. Two, that there is no equivalency to the black struggle. The black struggle is the radicalizing mechanism for all movements for progress in this country. And in that sense, there is no equivalent movement to it. And third, the principle of unity and principled unity. So it's those three principles that I think we can all agree upon. And that is why you get people like Vijay Prashad or Stephen Saleta or people from the Latino or Palestinian communities and movements coming to a conference on the black radical tradition. Because I think most people, be they in the queer movement, be they in the peace movement, be they in the environmental movement, if you are to the left and understand what that means, you will also understand what we call the centrality of the black liberation struggle, that this is the radicalizing vanguard movement in the history of the United States. So I think that's what we're bringing together. It's quite an accomplishment to get the people that we have together. It's a sign of a new stage of activism, a new stage of real people's politics, a new stage of the fight on all fronts. And I think we are looking at a period, we're on the beginnings, I would say, of a period of a generalized people's uprising that has the potentiality of fundamentally changing this country. Of course, not overnight, but this cannot occur, again, without ideological clarity, without real politics, and by that I mean not the politics of voting every 2 or 4 years, but the politics of organizing, the politics of fighting for consensus and unity. So that's what we're doing.
Kicking off that process, none too soon, back in 2008, the capitalist system went through one of its deepest crises in generations, and the left, including the black left, seemed to have very little response.
Right, because there was not a united black left. What we call the black left in 2008 were individuals, most of whom, in terms of the crisis, the economic financial collapse, and the 2008 election, fell behind the leadership of the liberals, which meant they subordinated what we assume to be their political program to that of neoliberal capitalists. Many of them did it through what I consider to be unprincipled and uncritical support for Barack Obama. There was not an economic critique, an economic discussion throughout the 2008 election, nor at any period in the Obama administration. In effect, there was no organized black left. And many would argue there hasn't been an organized black left for 25 or 30 years. So we have to rethink what that all means and how we achieve the summation of a black left in this period. Now, the conditions are far better for doing that than they have been in 40 years. So there's a sense of optimism, not just from the youth, and they are optimistic. They think they can do anything, but also from those more seasoned forces who come out of and have over their lifetime identified as black leftists.
So we're not just having a conference here. We're expecting that something concrete will come out of this conference in terms of folks who feel that they have a unity with one another and an operational relationship with one another.
Yes, I think that's what we're looking at. You know, take, for example, the Black Agenda Report and yourself in particular. In the same space with Charlene Carruthers of Black Youth Project 100, or with individuals coming out of the Black Lives Matter movement, in the same space with Stephen Kaleta of the movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, or with Vijay Prashad, or with Angela Davis. Now, even taking those names that I've mentioned, we're talking about the left, but a very diverse black left. People are different on Obama among the group coming to the conference. And among those keynoting, Angela supported Obama twice. Cornell supported him twice, but has been critical of him throughout. Cornell, for example, is endorsing Bernie Sanders. Black Agenda Report feels that's a dead-end street. Black Youth Project 100, coming out of Chicago, are waging a political campaign to force the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, to step down. That's a concrete on-the-ground political movement. What do they want after that? Do they want another Democrat? Do they want an independent? Do they want a change in the political geography of Chicago? Well, we don't know. The people coming out of St. Louis have other issues. Those coming from Baltimore, in the face of the Freddie Gray trials and the hung jury, what are they talking about? So when we talk about the left, we are talking in the broadest sense at this point. We're not talking of coming out of this with a political party, but we are hoping to establish networks of struggle, networks of discourse, networks of communication, which can be the groundwork for a coordinated national movement.
Well, it would be very easy to envision the personalities that you just spoke of coming together on a common line about police lawlessness. But what about the economy and how it should be organized? And in fact, the intricacies of U.S. foreign policy. How much commonality do you think is really there? Or is that something you find out at conferences like this?
I think achieving unity on questions of the economy will be the easiest part. I don't think there's a moment of doubt among any of the forces and individuals and organizations that have been in the street marching and mobilizing people about the fact that this economy, in terms of the people, has not recovered. In fact, when you look at things like income and such, things are probably worse than they were in 2009. In fact, what the latest statistics show, that 51% of American working people make below $30,000 a year. Now, if you translate that into poverty, we're looking at something like over half of the American people, and I would suggest upwards of 80% of the African-American people either living in poverty or very close to it. The austerity policies of the Obama administration have worsened the conditions of life for all working people. And in that sense, we have not come out. In fact, we are deeper in a depression for the people than we were in 2008 and 2009, even though the official statistics say that unemployment is down to close to 5%.
In terms of foreign policy, 100% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted in favor of Israel in a resolution before Congress at the height of Israel's assault on Gaza, in which 2,000 civilians were killed.
Well, the Black Congressional Caucus, and this is evidenced all over the country, is out of touch with the people, just like most of the elected officials are out of touch with the people. For example, in Chicago, all of the members of Congress, Black members of Congress, all of the members of the city council, I think, who are Black, and other state and local elected officials in Chicago supported Rahm Emanuel. It was because of that, and the Black vote, those who turned out, which was very low, by the way, that Emanuel won a second term for mayor. Now they're having to backtrack because the people are saying that Rahm Emanuel has to go. The same thing here in Philadelphia. The city administration, the city council, most of the Black elected officials support the policies of gentrification. The majority of Black folk don't support those policies. So there is a dramatic split in worldview and policy outlook between the masses of people and the elected officials. That is why the current movements are such a threat to the existing configuration of political forces within the Black community. And that's why, you know, again, this conference does have the potential, if not to fully effectuate change, to be a kind of a vanguard, something that stimulates and gives meaning to the demand that a people's movement is not a movement that can find itself ensconced in the Democratic Party. A people's movement must be independent of both the Democratic Party and the Black misleadership class must see its way through the pitfalls of bourgeois liberalism and find its own way, its own voice, its own worldview, its own leadership, its own organization. And that's what we're calling for. That's what we're looking at the potential of achieving.
And that also would be a source of struggle within the conference, given the makeup of the folks who will be there.
I think so. But, you know, Glenn, I don't think it's going to be that much of a struggle. I think the lessons of the last year cannot be missed. At the University of Missouri, a united front of Black students and their allies brought down the president of the university. Here in Philadelphia, at Temple University, the students are demanding that the chairman of the, and this goes also with the Faculty Senate, call for the chairman of the Board of Trustees removed from the Board of Trustees. And some of them are calling for the current president to be ousted. In Chicago, the movement is calling for the mayor to resign. Now, all of this means, in essence, that people are asking and demanding and going to put into force a change in power relationships. And I think everybody at this conference can agree to that.
But certainly everybody's not going to agree about the uses for or the dangers from the Democratic Party.
Probably not. But I don't think anybody coming to this conference is going to be excited about Hillary Clinton as the next president. And I don't think any of those who are coming to this conference who campaigned and supported Obama are going to be in the forefront of campaigning for or supporting Hillary Clinton, even in the face of the Republican Party's right-wing and further right-wing shift. I don't think that lesser of evils worldview and tactic is anything that's going to be supported or fought for at this conference. I don't know what people will do when they go home, but I dare say no one will have the audacity, if you will, to put on the table that we have to support Hillary Clinton. I don't even think people will call for the support of Bernie Sanders at this conference.
Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia. Omali Yesha Taylor, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, is wishing a very unhappy new year to Wall Street and U.S. imperialism. The consensus among the corporate media and the ruling circles in the United States is that the economy is doing just fine, that the U.S. is nearing full employment, and that that means the government will end its policy of giving trillions of dollars in interest-free money to the banks. But Omali Yesha Taylor says the system is in deep crisis.
I think the entire narrative around the economy in this country and globally, in fact, is insane. It's really crazy, and it is a clear demonstration, among other things, that the rulers of this country who dominate the world really don't understand. They're more like alchemists than anything else. There's nothing scientific or generally nothing scientific about what it is they say or do. I remember a few years ago, I don't even remember who the player was or the team he played for, but there was a report in a newspaper that in the locker room of one football team that a group of people had gathered around the locker of one player, and they were all laughing hysterically. And so this person went to see what it was, and what it was is that the scrotum one of the players had shrunk to the size of peas. And this is because of the use of testosterone, drugs, to enhance performance. And what happened, of course, is when they did that, then the system didn't have to produce its own capacity, and so the scrotum just shriveled up because it was useless. And I think that's part of what we can anticipate here with the so-called quantitative easing, the printing money to solve the economic crisis or to forestall the economic crisis or to keep things going is like an injection of testosterone to enhance performance. And I think that we're looking at some of the same outcomes as this football player that I was talking about. The fact is that even if it's not immediately obvious, you can't just keep printing money without devaluing the currency itself. And of course, we know that we're looking at fiat currency, that it's supposed to be worth something because the government says it's worth something, and it's the most powerful government with the biggest guns. And so the fact that we say it means that it's true. But the things that are happening surrounding this that will contribute to a loss of faith in this fiat currency, I believe that, first of all, that there's an economic crisis that has never been experienced before. I mean, they call this thing that's been happening since 2007, 2008 a recession, but the depth of it and longevity of it, it seems to me suggests something much worse than that. But I believe that economically there's even a greater and deeper and more acute crisis on the horizon, partially because of simply printing worthless money and the worthless money devaluing whatever there was out there. And then, of course, you've got the competition that's coming from other currencies who also are controlled by other forces with big guns, too, and with growing influence in the world. And it's China and the yuan and the kind of work that China has been doing to mobilize other countries and to creating this so-called basket of currencies for reserve as opposed to the United States. I think these are factors that will contribute to the weakening place and position. The fact is that the quantitative easing, as they call it, the fact is that now the Fed's decision to raise interest rate should only have come about, according to their logic, if other improvements had occurred in the economy. But those improvements have not occurred. There is no inflation that they recognize anyway, which was a precondition, they initially said, for raising the interest rate. The job situation, they said, is virtually no unemployment, which should have also created some, as what they define as inflation, that did not happen. The fact is economic productivity throughout this country has been flat at best everywhere. So nothing that they talk about has happened. Industrial production has dropped. Capacity utilization, as they call it, which measures what they call slack across industrial firms, that fell to 77% when it has historically been somewhere near 80%. My point is, this stuff, if it doesn't make any sense, it's because it doesn't make any sense, and that they have a crisis that they cannot recognize and cannot understand, and I think there's an explosion on the horizon. And it's going to be deeper and more acute than what we've just been experiencing up to now. Of course, the banks are fatter and fatter, but even that, I think, is going to prove to be problematic in this upcoming period.
The handwriting on the global historical wall is that China will soon overtake the United States as the world's top economic power, if it hasn't done so already. The Obama administration's response has been the so-called pivot to the Pacific, which translates in the real world as a warlike stance towards China.
It is warlike, and I think that what this helps us to see, for those who didn't quite understand it before, is that politics is simply concentrated economics. And China has been challenging the United States economically for a while now and has become a contender for hegemony in Asia. Even U.S. satellites are trading with China, and China has become the biggest trader for some of them. China is contending, as we all recognize, in Russia, the fastest growing economy there, et cetera, and which is a prompted movement with AFRICOM, and not just AFRICOM, but more deployment and planned deployment of U.S. forces throughout the continent of Africa. And then, of course, I didn't even mention the stuff that's happening in the South China Sea, where the U.S. is moving warships through areas that China claims as its own. And even if there's some dispute about whether China can legitimately claim it as its own, one thing is indisputable, and that it is clearly not U.S. waters that these warships are traveling in. So China is a big dog on the block, too, and this war-like efforts being made that we see is a political reflection of the economic stakes that are out there and the contention between the United States, the economic contention between the United States and China.
It appears that the great game that the United States and Saudi Arabia have been playing for nearly 40 years now is going sour, The U.S. and the Saudis spent billions to create the world's first international jihadist network in order to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. But now these Islamic fighters have plans of their own, and the U.S. proxy war against Syria seems to be collapsing.
It is an absolute chaotic situation for the imperialists in that area. All of the glue that held this unholy alliance and this array of forces in the Middle East together, all of it is disintegrating, coming apart. Partially, it is happening because more forces have been forced to see the inability of the U.S. to have its way as it used to be able to have its way in the past. The U.S. could not make Assad resign. The U.S. could not force Iran to not develop its own nuclear capacity. The world is watching the U.S. being pushed back in places like Ukraine, where it had created, manipulated the coup that overthrew the government that was friendly to Russia there. And so you see there's a greater desperation by forces on the ground in the Middle East, and many of them who have been characterized legitimately so as mere appendages of U.S. foreign policy, did at the same time, however, have their own interests. And when the U.S. exposes itself or is exposed as being incapable of protecting their own interests, some of them go into motion on their own, sometime in opposition to the immediate interests of the U.S., such as what Turkey has done now, refusing to move troops out of northern Iraq because Turkey needs those troops there to send proxy forces into train and send proxy forces into Syria to kill Syrians. But at the same time, to do that, they have to challenge the sovereignty of the Iraqi entity that the United States has created, undermining and embarrassing it, which is serious because of the great influence that Iran has achieved in Iraq, to the consternation and embarrassment of the United States that fought a war that overthrew a government and murdered more than 1 million people in order to achieve hegemony there. Now Iran comes out benefiting from that and strengthened in the process. And Iran also ends up being a part of a array of forces that are opposed to the U.S.'s primary military outpost, and that is Israel, which is now nakedly exposed and therefore more inclined to be able to go out on its own in order to protect its own existence. I mean, it's a bevy of contradictions. It's a madhouse in that situation. And the U.S. is incapable of directing the process in the fashion that it would direct it. The Saudis are slaughtering hundreds and thousands of people in Yemen because of a fear of growing Iranian influence there. And the U.S. gave it the green light and the support and all of the kind of satellite information that it needed to do that as a part of a deal to get the Saudis to sign on to the agreement that the United States had made with Iran. It's absolutely out of hand. The imperialists do not have anything that they can cheer about this holiday season. There is no ho, ho, ho in the White House.
The Republican Party seems to be in disarray, with Donald Trump, who's never held public office, the clear front runner. And on the other side of the political duopoly, Hillary Clinton has the corporate money, but nobody seems to like her or trust her, and for good reason.
We're talking about an election, presidential election contest that started off with at least 17 Republican contenders, 5 Democratic contenders that they will admit to. I say admit to because there are others who they just won't allow to have space. And this all is a reflection of a split in the bourgeoisie, because every one of them is somebody who represents the interests of a sector of the white ruling class itself in what is generally a nonviolent contest for control of the state. And it's a madness. And so you have this incredible confrontation. And what really makes it interesting is there's not a dime worth of difference in any of the candidates, with the possible exception of Trump being the sort of the bull in the tea shop, because he continues to, I think, expose some of the essential contradictions that people who expect the electoral process to solve their problems have to deal with. And that is the fact that Trump keeps saying that the reason that he is viable, that is to say Trump, is because he pays his own way while all the others are working for somebody else, that they do and say what the corporate bosses want them to do and say. And he says, I know it because I used to pay them to do what I wanted them to do. And so it's a real nasty contest. But when you look at it, there's not a dime's worth of difference between Cruz, Crump, or any of the others. In fact, as far as that is concerned, between the Republicans and the Democrats, I cannot see deep and profound differences. It's only nuanced in terms of how they articulate it. All of them are opposed to what they call the immigrants. All of them are white nationalists to the core, including Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. So this contest is one about which one of the persons who are running best reflect the interests of a sector of the ruling class, or even a lot of the sectors of the ruling class. It's not that, generally speaking, the ruling class requires absolute fidelity to a particular line, as long as it secures and promotes capitalism and world domination as a whole. So they won't necessarily lose, but the crisis is such that with the economic problems that are out there, the need for permanent warfare, pushing economic interests in a particular direction, that the bourgeoisie is fractured to the point that they put a lot of people and a lot of money out there to represent their interests. Their interests are splintered, and that's an interesting kind of thing to behold.
Some might say that the rulers are split when it comes to where they want to go, because there really is no exit available to them from the crisis of capitalism, that the contradictions are fatal to the system.
And I think that's absolutely right, because one of the things that I think that this crisis shows, should help us to understand, is that the possibility for revolution grows daily in terms of the crisis of imperialism itself. And at the moment that we understand that crisis is something that is actually required to make a revolution, then you won't find a better situation. And I think we're looking at a crisis that are going to grow and grow and grow. China's not going to go away. It's going to continue to contend with the U.S., and it's going to defeat the U.S. in many ways in terms on the economic front around the world. I think that's something you see, a trajectory, a trend there that's not going to go away. The people who are fighting in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and throughout the Middle East, they're not going to stop fighting. No matter how they are characterized, there are so many unresolved contradictions that keep the people living in the worst kind of poverty, worst kinds of absence of freedom. That struggle is not going to go away. In fact, what we see is the whole imperial order that has its origin in struggle that's been going on for the last 500 years or so, that order is unraveling. And I think we're going to see a deepening crisis. And the thing that bodes well for the struggle here in the United States, there are several, but one thing certainly is that we've got a generation of African people who have grown up, who have come into consciousness, having experienced 15 years of unremitting warfare that the United States has initiated against other peoples around the world unsuccessfully. We got a whole generation of people who've seen North Korea, who've seen Iran, who've seen Chavez and other people around the world tell the U.S. to stuff it. The important, ideologically significant appearance of absolute world dominance, absolute invincibility has been fractured. And that has impacted the consciousness of African people in this country, too, along with the fact that the proverbial straw on the camel's back was dropped on the August 9th, 2014. The resistance in Ferguson that thrilled and raised the morale and consciousness of African people throughout this country that has seen ongoing rebellions, and I anticipate we'll see more and more of that. Plus, the thing is that while people who come from Pakistan and other places in the world and who pick up guns and shoot people in Santa Barbara, or come from Algeria or some other countries and shoot people in France, they're called immigrants sometimes. But the immigration question often in the United States is disguised by terms like American mean white people, and African American mean black people, and Mexican American, and a whole number of other people who have been so categorized in order to obscure the colonial relationship that we enjoy with this social system. And what we saw in Santa Barbara, of course, was an explosion of the colonial question right there in California. Possibly that's what we saw. I mean, there's so much smoke and what have you that's been used to color that situation. But clearly, in this country, the colonial subjects, the most slandered and brutalized and attacked colonial population of black people in this country, we're going to see more and more resistance by a population that has come to understand that the U.S. and white power are not invincible, that peoples around the world are fighting them successfully. So from my perspective, we have to build a revolutionary capacity. We have to begin moving not just for protest, not just the movement is everything, but to actually talk about projecting a revolutionary struggle. And we have to be preparing ourselves to govern ourselves. And I'm not saying this as some kind of deranged nationalist who assumes that white power and the white man is going to do this and that, but as somebody who recognizes that the nature of the social system itself is extremely oppressive, and that it requires for its success the ongoing blood-sucking of the rights and resources, the humanity, the very humanity of vast majority of people around the world. And of course, that means Africans in this country. It means the people in these concentration camps that they call Indian reservations. It means all of those people who have been characterized as illegals because they dare to cross a border that was created in 1848 at gunpoint to buy an army that was from the United States that stole half of Mexico. These are profoundly deep contradictions that are now percolating and some places actually exploding. And I think this is the extraordinarily important, happy, brilliant future that we're looking for over the coming year.
That was Omali Yeshitela of the Black is Back Coalition. Earlier this year, a 27-year-old teacher from Southeast Washington, D.C., died at the hands of two special police officers. The recently formed Pan-African Community Action Group, or PACA, wants to take the case before the United Nations. PACA organizer Netfa Freeman explains.
On November 1st, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department got calls about a disturbance in Mulberry Plaza Apartments in Southeast D.C. The calls were about someone running through the hallway screaming, "Help, help, they're trying to kill me." When they got arrived to the scene, they found Alonzo Smith face down, handcuffed, unresponsive, pretty much dead. The news keeps reporting it as he was not breathing, but he was dead at the scene. And then on top of him was a special police officer. Now, these special police officers, they're private police, a private security firm called Blackout Investigations. They were hired by Mulberry Plaza Apartments. They were under their employment, the special police, and they had him in custody, and one was standing by, and the other one was over him with his knee in his back. Alonzo was face down on the ground, but his head was leaning over the stairwell. The police officer got up off top of him, and they found he wasn't breathing. The Metropolitan Police started doing some kind of life-saving measure, CPR, which didn't work. Now, since then, the Smith family got notified of it, I think, the day after. Since then, the D.C. police have seemed to be covering up what happened. They will not release any significant information about the case, particularly the names, identities of the two special police officers, why they were detaining him in the first place at all, arresting him in the first place, what happened in the incident, what their version of what happened is, and more telling, they will not say the relationship. The special police are licensed and sanctioned by the District of Columbia Metropolitan Police Department. They won't say what this relationship is because obviously with most people may not know that regular security guards are not able to detain you. They're not able to arrest you. And so these evidently have their private police, which actually have the powers of evidently of all regular police officers, even so that their identity don't even have to be disclosed.
And so it seems that the D.C. police are extending their blue wall to surround these special police, these rent-a-cops.
Right, exactly. One thing we do know about the Blackout Investigation, the owner of the organization is Guy Black, and he's a former Maryland state trooper. And we know that just because they're former, these types of wall of protection doesn't end because someone's no longer a police officer. We don't know if the security guards, if these special police, they call them special police, and they're not just operating in Washington, D.C. They're around the country. They have an acronym, SCOPS. They could possibly be regular police officers moonlighting in the security. They could be former police officers. They could not be have been police officers at all. And it turns out that the training required in Washington, D.C. is only 40 hours of training to become one of these special police. And in many places, it's a very small amount of training compared to the months and months of training that is required for people to become regular police officers. They can carry guns. And so the city is not forthcoming in any of the details that surround this relationship of special police or the details of the case of Alonzo Smith, in spite of his family asking, particularly his mother, Beverly Smith, asking and demanding more details. Since then, the case has been submitted to a grand jury and gone up to the Justice Department investigating the case or, you know, claiming they're investigating the case, but still not disclosing anything. Apparently, according to the autopsy report and according to Ms. Smith, Beverly Smith, his mother, having been able to view his body, Alonzo Smith was beaten to death. The D.C. government and the autopsy report is claiming that there was some level of cocaine, a small level of cocaine in his body, and that they make it sound like that was the main cause of death, only exacerbated by the compressions by the knee and the back. But they're not saying anything. They're not even mentioning in the media him being beaten to death.
And quite tellingly, Alonzo's mother doesn't want to spend a lot of time asking the Department of Justice to intervene in this case because she says the Department of Justice doesn't really take effective action when cops are involved. And I guess she means special cops as well.
Yeah, she does. I mean, obviously, and we've seen it across the country with all kinds of cases where they initiate these grand juries and then the Justice Department does an investigation, and it's pretty much only a slap on the wrist. No police officers have been convicted of these murders, what seem to be obviously apparent murders of us across the country. And so in line with Ms. Smith's suspicions and along with our assessment is that we're calling for the United Nations to come in and do an independent investigation, not only of this particular case, but also of the many, many cases across the country of black people, particularly young people, being murdered by police officers.
And you say this is in the spirit of the We Charge Genocide petition of 1951 and the many pronouncements of Malcolm X on this subject.
It is in that line with the We Charge Genocide, in addition to calling for the United Nations to come in and do an investigation, even if their findings are convicting of the police officer, that this is going to stop the killings by police in our communities. We feel that the only thing to stop that and another one of our demands is community control of the police, which is also in line with a call by the Black Panther Party in the 60s and 70s for community control of the police. And we believe that this is different from all these other things that people are talking about, civilian review boards and community policing, which is really pretty much a relationship with the community and the police, but actually controlling the police, meaning that we would have control over everything from the budget that they have, from hiring and firing, to determining what their duties are in our community, to being able to determine who they are.
And that would, of course, include hiring and firing of police chiefs like the one you have now, who is not allowing the family to even get a good picture on who these cops were that killed her son.
Yes, that would include everything from top down, who is in charge of the police. Particular communities would be able to control who is policing in their communities. This would be done by two boards. One would be more local and temporary, where people would be able to make decisions on incidents that would happen and be able to determine what type of measures should be taken or consequences. And then also more rotating board, where people will be able to determine the larger issues around the policing in the communities and in the city at large. These will be non-elected bodies, so it would be something that people would have a civic responsibility to participate in. And so people around the community would have their chance to have a say on these things, especially those who are subject to the indiscretions of the police.
So one would not run for a position on the community control board, but would be part of a pool of people who would be eligible for positions on the board.
Right. And our position is you're eligible as long as you're a D.C. resident. It would be a randomly selected thing, rotating thing, much like people are given jury duty. And, of course, you'd be we would have to provide, but because the community is controlling of it, we'd have to take into consideration different barriers to serving. So we'd have to have services and things like that for people to allow them to serve. Of course, if the community has control of it, then we'd be able to shape this the way we want, including helping it be possible for people to serve on the boards.
That sounds like an interestingly democratic approach to policing.
Yes, and I think in line with some of the articles, international articles that actually talk about people having the right, the human right to informed consent and self-determination. So that presupposes a democratic say in things like how your community is policed and all kinds of things that happen in our communities. And so, yeah, it definitely calls for true democracy and not this farce that is generally called democracy in this country, where people who have more money and different class status are able to have disproportionate amount of control over things that don't even happen in their own communities.
And what about police union rights? Police have been using their union powers to provide themselves with a Bill of Rights Plus that gives them more protections than the average citizen, protections they could use against a police community control board.
And that's why we're calling for a referendum that would actually make this binding law. And so we're not claiming or fooling ourselves that this is going to be an easy road, but it's definitely something we have to undertake in order to survive, save our lives against this system and the role that the police play in this system. So we're saying that if we initiate laws, then those laws, just like any union, are bound by the laws of the city, of the state, of the country. Pan-African Community Action is a Pan-Africanist organization, so we believe our destiny, our circumstances are bound up with the circumstances of other people of African descent around the world, and that right now, because of the historical role of the police going all the way back to the first earliest U.S. police and then being the antecedents from the slave patrols and from the private security firms that protected property, now the special police are just coming full circle round back to private policing, and that the police are occupying. We're a domestic colony. We're a colony within a colony, and the police are occupying force in our community. So we have to organize in a way that eliminates it, dispels this occupying force from our communities, and then we also have a program that addresses all aspects of community control, not just of the police, but of our economies, different things that have to do with being liberated as a people.
Education, so, housing,
etc. So if I may, I can just read quickly our mission statement. Pan-African Community Action is a grassroots group of African, black people organizing for community-based power in the D.C., Maryland, and Virginia metropolitan area. We undertake to build community-led power through participatory programs of action and political education drives that avow and advance our human right to informed consent and self-determination. This pursuant to a lot of international articles. Collective community control over local economies, community control over the police, and a movement led by the most impacted of our communities. PACA is explicitly anti-capitalist. We stand against all forms of race, class, gender, and sexually orientation-based oppression. We stand for full community access to resources to realize a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of individuals and families, including food, clothing, housing, medical care, and necessary social services. We also believe all people have the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood and circumstances beyond one's control. We assume the historic mission of Malcolm X in seeking to take the cause of African black people within the U.S. to the United Nations, elevated from an issue of civil rights to the level of human rights and the world stage.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network. You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.